From WBUR Boston, I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Orwell's 1984 nightmare, the society in which children denounced their parents to the secret police, had its roots in Stalin's Russia, which put the total in totalitarianism, conducting history's biggest experiment in obliterating private life. Now, for the first time in the West, we have the inside story of ordinary Russians told by prize-winning historian Orlando Figes. His subject is the Stalinism of everyday life. This hour, On Point, Private Life in Stalin's Russia. You can join the conversation. Did you or your family live under Stalin? What do you remember? What do you try to forget? What's your question for Orlando Figes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Orlando Figes, professor of history at the University of London and, according to London's Guardian, one of the world's most respected Russian historians. He's the author of Natasha's Dance and A People's Tragedy, A History of the Russian Revolution. His new book is The Whisperers, Private Life in Stalin's Russia. It is based on years of research by researchers who uncovered hundreds of hidden family archives. Orlando Figes, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jack. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Let me just say right at the start here, this book is will live, I believe, as long as men and women remember totalitarianism. It is, for those who have read your People's Tragedy, it is the book we would expect. But that is to say, it is a book of really rare merit. And it's a work of history which is informed everywhere by moral judgment, but is never moralistic. You make everything, even the villains, understandable. And so I really praise you and the book unreservedly.
That's very kind, yeah.
I wonder if you could set us up first with this. This is in some sense a collective endeavor. Can you tell us the prehistory of this book?
Yes, it really goes back to my graduate days in Moscow in the mid-1980s, when I got to know a lot of families and came to see how their memory was a moral counterbalance, really, to the official version of history. And although that was never possible to explore in the Soviet period, from the 1990s I became increasingly interested in this. But it was probably only in the last few years that it was possible to get people to reflect about their lives and to look inside themselves in the way that they have done for our project. And beginning in about 2002, when I finished Natasha's Dance, I began to travel around Russia, recovering those links with those families and through their friends, interviewing people old enough to remember the Stalin period as adults, and to try and persuade them to give me their family archives for scanning, which they did. And then I got a grant from two British institutions, and I entered into partnership with the Memorial Society. Now, the Memorial Society was set up in the late 1980s by volunteers, really, to commemorate victims of repression, and it's a human rights organization, and it carried out its own oral history projects, recovering the history of the Gulag in the 1990s. And I think in some ways I steered them in a new direction by looking at family history, because they'd been asking questions about moments of arrest, conditions in the Gulag, and we were beginning to ask new questions about how Stalinism had affected internal family life, relationships, how families passed down values to children from even pre-revolutionary days, if those values were in conflict with the public system of Soviet ideology. And to look at how you say, you know, this is about the Stalinism inside of ordinary people, that's very much the focus of the Whisperers, to get people to look inside themselves and see how Stalinism affected them, both in terms of coping with repression as a family, but also in terms, you know, inevitably of internalizing the values of the system and living in that sort of conflict between the public system where they have to make their lives and the family life, the private interior world, which is so often in conflict with that.
Yes, you mentioned this is different from the official version. It's also different from the version that those of us in the West have been getting from literary memoirs. I think of Nadezhda Mendelsohn, Hope Against Hope, where you really see persons of unexampled nobility holding out against the suasions and the terrors of this regime, and it just they just seem the keynote, even if they don't play it up, is heroic. This is different.
Yeah, absolutely. That was very much my starting point. I mean, I think our notion of what it was like to live through Stalinism is very much informed by these intelligentsia memoirs written basically in the 1960s, where, yeah, you're right, it's a story of the individual spirit of the human being surviving. But that's, although that's a truth for many people, it's not a truth, I don't think, for the vast mass of ordinary people who are the subjects of our project, where, in fact, after the Khrushchev thaw of 1956 and after, you know, the silence and the fear continued, and people didn't speak out, they didn't write their memoirs, and the levels of fear we still encountered in the 2000s were much more common. And I think among those people we found a very different story, which is not so much the survival of the human spirit, although it's there, the resilience of the family is something that really comes out of this project.
Well,
it's also how, you know, people actually were broken by the system, how they collaborated with the system, how inevitably they found moral compromises with the system, it just in order to survive. So it's a much more complicated figure than that sort of heroic story of the individual spirit.
I wonder if you can give us emblematic stories from the different periods you treat of. For example, you have a chapter, The Children of 1917, and there you point out how the regime, as you say, strove to sweep away all signs of petty bourgeois domesticity, the ornamental china on the mantelpiece, the singing canaries, all the plants, soft furniture, family portraits, and other banal objects of the domestic hearth, and move toward a higher and more spiritual existence. Give us an illustrative story of that effort on the part of the regime to really sort of make people into social atoms, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think very much the project of the Bolsheviks in the 1920s was to drive people into the public sphere, to obliterate this bourgeois family, as they called it, which they saw as a sort of nest of the old values of the patriarchalism, the superstition that they wanted to sweep away. This was obviously in the vanguard of this life were party families. And they really overturned the old system of values in the way they lived their private lives. I mean, one woman who's very much one of our heroines is a woman called Marksena Nikiforova, who's the daughter of two senior party officials in Leningrad. And you know, they had a sort of rather Spartan attitude to the way they should bring up their children. No material possessions, no concentration on physical, personal appearance. And Marksena was very much brought up to be a sort of little comrade from a very early age. So she tells us a story, for example, how at the age of seven, when she first went to school at the beginning of September, it would have been about 1932, her mother took her across Leningrad, a walk of nearly 3 miles, and told her to remember the route, because from that afternoon onwards she would have to find her way to and back from school. And so that sort of, you know, sort of sense that children had to bring themselves up to be independent comrades almost, affected the whole of Marksena's life. And she found very little affection from her parents. Indeed, many children of party parents, you know, the parents were out working all day, came back late at night. And so, like so many children of that generation, Marksena, like others, found affection from her grandmother, who was sort of often the person that she could see and go
from
and play.
The nanny.
Or from the nanny. The grandmothers and the nannies are the figures where the old values continue to be brought into the family. Obviously, nannies mainly from peasant families. And grandmothers often were the people who baptized children, often in secret, or told children about what it was like, or implicitly gave them signals about how they should interpret the world, whether they should still believe in God, or what sort of values they should have. And so these grandmothers were mainstays of the family in many ways. But in Marksena's case, that sort of independence in which she was brought up from a very, very early age, stood her in good stead because, as with so many of these party families, both her parents were swept away in 1937 and she was left at the age of about 13, coping entirely on her own, looking after two younger half-brothers in a communal apartment on her own.
Mm-hmm. So what we have to remember about this early period is this was informed not so much by terror as by idealism, an idea of what the family should be, an idea of loyalty to the state and the party as you know, above everything.
Absolutely. The party, the proletariat, collective organizations like the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League, clubs and things like this were all forms of sort of higher social belonging which were to replace the family. Mm. It was really quite explicit in Bolshevik ideology that the party saw that the family as something that was on its way out. The family, I mean, even in terms of, you know, planning for the new ideal city, they were thinking in terms of communal big apartment blocks where the family would be broken down because children would be brought up in kindergartens and there'd be domestic, you know, communal laundries and communal kitchens. Women and men would both go out to work and children would be effectively brought up by the state. This was very much the ideology of the 1920s, but of course it turned out to be rather utopian.
Joining me today from London is Orlando Figes, world-renowned historian and professor at the University of London. His new book is The Whisperers, Private Life in Stalin's Russia. Orlando, give us what you mean, whisperers. This was a word that came into, that took on a peculiar significance in Russia in the 20s.
Yeah, I focused on that word. I mean, it kept coming up in interviews. But basically, there are two words in Russian for a whisperer. One is shiptushi, which simply means someone who whispers because they don't want to be overheard, which is perhaps how the majority of the Soviet population lived under Stalin. People were brought up not to talk in public, to be very careful what they said, even in communal apartments where the walls were very thin, and any thing overheard could lead to denunciations. But the other word for a whisperer is shiptun, which is a more derogatory term for somebody who whispers behind people's backs and has the meaning of someone who informs on others to the police. So it just struck me that actually Soviet society was made up of one form of whisperer or another. And that collision is something that I wanted to bring out in the book.
Mm. Your next section is the Great Break. It's a phrase from Stalin, and it's it's the story of the forced industrialization of Russia. Within a matter of a year, millions of people were forced onto collective farms. And I must say that reading it as someone who'd read, you know, Isaac Deutscher and others in the past, the word kulak, which by Marxist historians, as I recall, is still used with a certain negative connotation. This is a terrible, frightful libel, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the kulaks were supposedly capitalist, exploitative peasants, hiring poor peasants. But in fact, a kulak during Stalin's collectivization of agriculture was any peasant who resisted collectivization. It was industrious peasants. It was sober, hard-working peasants. It was peasants who simply didn't want to join the collective farm. And millions of families were denounced and arrested and sent into exile and labor camps as kulaks during the collectivization of agriculture, partly as an example to others to teach them not to resist collectivization, and partly just to wipe out any resistance to the collective farms. And, you know, in some cases, it was even arbitrary. I mean, quotas came down to the villages to arrest a certain number of people as kulaks. Let me give you one example, actually, because one of our heroes is a man called Dmitry Streletsky, who came from the Kurgan region of southern Russia. And, you know, in 1948, 18 years after his family was broken up and sent into exile and given just an hour to pack all their belongings, there were 14 children in the family. Mm. 18 years later, Dmitry went back to his village and he met the village Soviet chairman there. And he recalls how his parents were selected for deportation as kulaks. Let me quote you what he says. Mm-hmm. There was no inspection or calculation. They simply came and said to us, "You are going." Serkov, the chairman of the village Soviet who deported us, explained, "I have received an order from the district party committee to find 17 kulak families for deportation. I formed a committee of the poor, and we sat through the night to choose the families. There is no one in the village who is rich enough to qualify, and not many old people, so we simply chose the 17 families. You were chosen, he explained to us. Please don't take it personally. What else could I do? So in other words, this village Soviet chairman simply had to pick families to be deported. And the Strelitsky family, 14 people, grandparents, parents, and about 10 children, I think, were given an hour to pack all their belongings and sent into Siberia in exile.
Mm.
And he tells terrible stories of what happened to the family out there. I mean, we asked him, what was it like? How did it affect family relations? And he said, you know, we were given 200 grams of bread for the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
That's 14 people. But the bread came in a big block, and they cut it off, and we didn't know how to distribute the bread equally to all the children. So they made a very primitive balance, and they would measure it up crumb by crumb to make sure everyone got the same. So it wasn't a question of how we got on. It was a question simply of survival.
You know, you show two forces here. You show the force of the state trying to break up the family, and this emblemized in the story of Pavlik Morozov, a young man who was murdered after denouncing his parents and who then became a kind of hero of Stalin era. And the force of biology, of the family unit, of people walking thousands of miles to reunite their families. The Soviets tried to destroy the family, but they were working on something deeper rooted than ideology.
Absolutely. That's something that just kept coming out, especially among all these stories we collected of Kulak families separated by thousands of miles, most typically because, like, the father would be arrested as a Kulak and sent to the Gulag, sent to a labor camp, and then the wife and other children or those who didn't flee would end up in a special settlement, which were penal settlements of exile, where they were basically dumped onto wilderness and left to fend for themselves or put to work in felling timber. But, you know, we just collected amazing stories of people walking thousands of miles, escaping from labor camps, escaping from penal settlements, going in search of fragments of their family, reuniting them, sometimes crossing the country several times, and then living on the run. Or ending up in casual labor, escaping the system that tried to control movements of population by having a passport system introduced so that you couldn't find work or residence anywhere without a passport. But they would evade this and live on the margins of society just in order to keep together as a family. And they are just extraordinary stories. But, you know, this thing of Pavlik Morozov was very, very interesting because, yeah, you're right. This was the sort of public ideal that Soviet propaganda focused on, that children were to put loyalty to the state, loyalty to Father Stalin, above loyalty to their biological parents. Mm-hmm. And if their parents said something against the state or if they were kulaks, they were encouraged by their schools and pioneer organizations to denounce their parents. And although denunciations were extremely rare, in all the interviews we did, and we interviewed over 1,000 people in all, we found a great deal of sort of implicit renunciation of parents, you know, and that was not to say that they consciously renounced their parents. It's simply that once their parents had been repressed as kulaks or had suffered other forms of discrimination, the children of that generation were still going through schools. They were still trying to make careers for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, willy-nilly, they ended up renouncing them, even if they didn't see it that way at the time. I mean, let me just give you one example. Mm-hmm. There's a woman called Lyuba Tetyuva, and her father was a priest in the Perm region of the Urals, and he was repressed many times, arrested many times, and refused to turn informer against his congregation. And then finally, he was arrested and sent to the Gulag. And Lyuba herself at this time was 16, desperately wanted to join the Komsomol, the Communist Youth mm-hmm. Organization, and she did, and she became a very active member of the Komsomol in anti-religious campaigns. At the time, she didn't see it that way. At the time, she just saw it as normal, that's what children should do. And it was only very many years later, I think, that she sort of came to look into herself, in fact, under interviews for the first time, really, maybe, began to look into herself at what that had meant in terms mm-hmm. of the memory of her father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She hadn't She hadn't explicitly denounced her father. Her older brother had done in order to join the Komsomol. But she had simply taken another path. And mm-hmm. so there were millions of people mm-hmm. who did that. And mm-hmm. so ask the question about Pavlik Morozov, although it doesn't confront people about explicit denunciation or explicit renunciation, does stir up very awkward memories.
Indeed. Let's take a call from Aminat.
Hello, Aminat.
Yes. Am I on the air?
You are on the air, yes. Hello, welcome.
Thank you very much. I was born in Kazakhstan, but my parents was born in North Caucasus, in a very small place. They call that Ingushetia. It's between Chechnya and Cherkassian Republic. Why I born in Kazakhstan? Because my parents was deported from their place, and when I was 7, we went back to original place in North Caucasians. Mm-hmm. And I remember that my two grandmas, they was Jews, and grandpas was Ingushian men. But I remember that my grandma was afraid to tell us that we are Jews, because I'm a little bit emotional.
Sure.
Because being Jew in Russia never was good, still is not good. And I remember that my parents never talk about good or bad that government, because I assume that they was afraid that kids will talk about in school
yes.
or something, and they will be in trouble.
Yes.
Orlando,
you tell so many of stories like this, and particularly about the Jews. You know, in the early period, the Bolsheviks, and I think wrongly, were thought of, well, their main leaders are Jews. That was just the canard. Mm. But you point out there was a sort of tolerance of Jews, rare in Russian society, during the 20s. But this really changed, especially after the war. Talk to us about that.
Firstly, let me say I really sympathize with Aminat's family history, and it's also typical and very typical that parents didn't tell children about their identity for fear of children talking and bringing punishment to the family, and indeed for stigmatizing the children. In a way, it was easier for children of Aminat's generation to go through Soviet society not knowing the truth, because then they could not feel the alienation from Soviet society, not feel the stigma, and actually lie unknowingly, to fill out the forms they had to fill out in order to go to university, where they had to declare whether they had parents who'd been repressed or deported, and they could say quite honestly with a clear conscience no, because that's what they thought. Sadly, yes, you're right. There was in the 1920s a sort of internationalism, and Jews were very prominent in the Soviet experiment and very much caught up in the ideals of the revolution. And Yiddish culture, Jewish culture, flourished in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. But then, beginning really with the war, and certainly after the war, I think one could say that internationalism was replaced by Great Russian Chauvinism as the dominant ideology of the Soviet state, and Stalin instituted a campaign of initially called anti-cosmopolitanism.
Let me interrupt for just one second. Yeah. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. Please resume, Orlando.
Yes. After the war, this anti-cosmopolitan campaign was first initiated against people in literature and theatre criticism, but spread very quickly to be a general anti-Semitic campaign. Being a Jew was like being members of other nationalities. German, for example, was already a stigma, and there were many, many people who suffered as a result.
And as you point out, this was partly driven by Stalin's disappointment that Israel had not turned out to be a Soviet ally.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think in the early post-war years, Stalin hoped that he could turn the emerging Jewish state into a sort of pro-Soviet sphere. But once it became clear that Israel was going to be in the Western camp, he turned against all the Jewish organizations within the Soviet Union and instituted this anti-Jewish campaign. And the Jew became the enemy, in a way replacing the enemy of the people of the 1930s. And this nationalism that the Soviet state very much depended on after 1945 was focused against the Jews as the alien element. And the Israeli-American axis, so to speak, replaced the fascist axis of before 1941. And that had massive consequences, obviously, for the post-war Soviet repressions, which have received less attention, I think, on the whole, than the repressions of the 1930s, but which in many ways were worse.
Oh, indeed. Amanat, thank you very much for your moving call. R.D. is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hello.
Jack, hello. Hello, Professor. In the mid-80s to early 90s, I made several reporting trips to the old Soviet Union and spent a number of nights around family tables with Russians who were telling these terrible stories, the sort of stories you've been talking about. But they, and also in almost the same breath, they recounted with great pride the Red Army saving the Rodina, the motherland, from the Nazis in World War II. Your thoughts on that apparent disconnect there? And then secondly, you mentioned the grandmothers and the importance. What about any role of the Russian Orthodox Church in all of this?
Yeah, Adi, great, two fantastic questions. Yeah, very much I agree with you about the war. There is a conflict, but I think it can be explained quite easily. You know, there's an official memory of the war, which is that it's the victory of the system, and in the post-war years, and I think Putin still today uses it to justify everything that happened under the Soviet system since 1917. But in the collective memory, the war was a people's war. The people won the war through their own patriotic effort for the defense of their homeland. And in a way, curiously, it was a time of relative freedom because they were left to their own initiative. They had to take action just to defend themselves. And so the sort of tight political control of the party, although terror continued in the war years, it was somewhat relaxed. And some historians even refer to it as a period of spontaneous de-Stalinization. And I think to some extent that's true. And that's why people remember the war years rather nostalgically as a time of relative freedom. Although that does sound curious, you know, although they were living under the threat of bombing and the German army all the time, they were no longer afraid in the way that they had been afraid in the 1930s. And they found comradeship and they found solidarity with their fellow soldiers in small collective units, which I think in spite of the party, in spite of the system, won the war for the Soviet Union.
And as you point out, the terrible irony, they were fighting for the Soviet Union. Before the break, Orlando, R.D. was asking about the role of the Orthodox faith in under Stalin and in family life.
Well, obviously for the generation of believers in the Soviet system in the 1930s, it was a time when the Orthodox faith and other religions were, on the whole, renounced for this public culture. But, you know, we were mentioning the grandmothers. They were very much the people in our experience who carried on the faith and brought it into the home. But it was something that was concealed. Icons might be hidden behind a curtain. They might be put inside a cupboard somewhere. And so instead of going to the church, which could bring repression to a family if children were seen going to church, families observed their faith more often at home. So it became something very private. There was a period in the war when there was a relaxation of discrimination against the church and many parish churches opened. But then, of course, soon after the war, that was closed down again. But the continuation of the faith is something that is very interesting, and you can only get at by looking at the how family traditions and values were passed down. And it's something that people didn't talk about outside the home, but which they did talk to us about how they had preserved that.
You know, from your chapter on the Great Fear, the purges of the late 30s, you have an extraordinary scene of a family, a man named Slavina,
taken away, very high placed in the sort of military bureaucracy, taken away at night from his family. And he turns to his daughter, Ida, as he's going down the stairs to his death, and he says, "Little one, my beloved daughter, there are mistakes in history, but remember, we started something great. Be a good young communist." He's going to his death. The system is going to kill him. And yet he says, this is a mistake in history, but overlook it.
Yeah, that belief is something which is, it still astounds me, but it's perhaps one of the strongest things that came out of the project. Just how people continued believing in the Soviet system despite everything that they knew about it from personal experience. And the next generation, Ida's generation, and Ida's still alive and lives in Cologne, that generation continued to believe in the system despite knowing what it had done to their parents.
Mm.
So many people would tell us, yes, I believe my father was innocent, although he'd been arrested as an enemy of the people. I knew instinctively he was innocent, but I still believed in Stalin. I still believed in the existence of enemies of the people. And that was not just a faith in the system as an ideology. I think it was a need perhaps to... I mean, if you didn't believe in that, then how were you going to make sense of your own suffering? I think that's the heart of the issue. So people would even come back from the camps with their faith intact. Because if they gave that up, then there was absolutely nothing to justify the suffering they'd undergone.
Right.
Let me quote you something, actually, from Ida, because what she says is very, very interesting. And it says a lot about that generation, about how they had to move on and cope with the stigma and how they wanted to belong. She, like many people, she says there's a moment in her biography when, despite the stigma of her father's repression, she felt she could overcome that. And that was for her, as a Komsomol member, she became a member of the Communist Youth League, as her father had exhorted her to do. And there was a moment, she says, when she suddenly realized that she belonged and she could overcome this stigma. And it was the moment when she was asked to join in the school gymnastics display on a parade. And she says, and let me quote her what she says, "I was 16. I couldn't stand to be unhappy. I longed for happiness and love. But there was more to it than that. Joining the parade was also an expression of my deep desire to feel whole again in my shattered world, to feel again the sensation of being part of an enormous we. Marching in columns with everybody else, singing the proud song, 'We Have No Borders,' it seemed to me that I was indeed a fully equal representative of my motherland. I was filled with the belief in the words of the song that we would carry our Soviet banner over worlds and centuries. I was with everyone. My friends and teachers once again believed in me, and that meant, or so I thought, that they must also believe in my parents' innocence."
Mm.
So in other words, being accepted in the collective fold as a child of an enemy of the people in some way restored your dignity, and therefore the dignity of your unjustly
suffering.
Repressed
yes and if the worst came to the worst, you could say, well, it wasn't Stalin, it was his people around him. Again and again,
absolutely,
that comes out, people saying, oh no, Stalin didn't mean this was the head of his secret police, this was somebody else. Stalin really, why, he cares about us, he's our father.
Absolutely. We have many people like that. I mean, the Dmitry Strelitsky, whom I mentioned before, the man repressed as a kulak and sent into exile with his 14 members of his family. He tells us how years later, after again joining the Komsomol, becoming a physics teacher in a school in his special settlement, we asked him, well, did you believe in Stalin? He said, yes, of course I believed in Stalin. How could I not believe in Stalin? He believed in the enemies of the people. And he says, you know, in a funny way, he says, believing in the existence of enemies of the people made it easier for us to sustain ourselves. It made it easier for us to bear our punishments if we believed there was some sort of rationale.
Mm-hmm. Josh is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Jack. This is Josh Rubenstein.
Oh, Josh. Hi. This is
we
should tell Orlando that you are a member of Amnesty International, and for
a long
time.
I'm the Northeast Director.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to make one comment. You know, there's this, I don't particularly like making the comparison between Nazi Germany and Stalin's Soviet Union, but there's one point that needs to be made, I think, in this context, that after the defeat of Nazi Germany, the post-war German government fully repudiated the legacy of Hitler, and we had the Nuremberg trials, whereas nothing similar happened in the Soviet Union or in Russia today. The Communist Party today is still an apologist for Stalin. And even Putin, who occasionally makes comments about the purges and about the legacy of Stalinism is still very much engaged in sugarcoating the years of Stalinism. There's really been no full accountability or repudiation or even apology to the Russian people or everyone in the former Soviet space for what happened. I think that contributes to the tragedy.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, Josh. And I think, you know, there was a very short period under Gorbachev in the early 1990s when all of this was brought out into the public sphere and discussed. But then it was, as you say, really brushed under the carpet. And now Putin is indeed trying to normalize the Soviet experience and put a positive gloss on the Stalin period of history and encourage Russians to take pride in that period of history, if only for the war. And I think that in some way made our heroes, the members of Memorial and others who contributed to the project, made them, I think, feel more marginalized in Russian society today. And I think it was one reason why so many of them were ready to talk to us between 2003 and 2006, when we interviewed and took archives from all these hundreds of families. One of the reasons was perhaps because, you know, they'd reached that stage in their lives when they needed to talk and get these things off their chest, to share with people who were sympathetic their sense of injustice that they'd live with. And the fear perhaps that the younger generation wouldn't be interested in it. But I think what Josh has said is very relevant here, which is that they also felt that since 2000 perhaps, increasingly, that their dignity had been taken, that they had not had the recognition that they, yes, they had had in earlier, the Yeltsin period.
Yes. In fact, we have an illustrative clip. Last week, NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer reported on the current whitewashing of Soviet history in Putin's Russia. In that report, former Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev, who helped dissolve the Soviet Union, said his role was being written out of Russian history books as nostalgia mounts for the old system. Though he didn't criticize Putin directly, Gorbachev said the trend puts Russia at risk of a return to Stalinism. Let's listen.
A new history is being created. Stalin's rule was a golden age. Khrushchev was a utopia. Brezhnev was a continuation of the golden age. None of this today is happening by chance.
Not happening by chance, Orlando, that in some ways this current regime is using the nationalist emphasis of the communist period to legitimize itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the key to it is the Soviet victory of 1945, which Putin keeps coming back to. He gave a speech to school teachers in June of this year, encouraging them to give a more positive assessment of the Stalin period precisely because of the war. And it's essentially nationalism. You know, there's only really two sort of myths that the Russian state can rely on. One is the greatness of Russian culture, Pushkin and Tolstoy, and the other is the victory of 1945. There's really nothing else that holds it together. And Putin is constantly coming back to that. But of course, it's crucially important at this stage for people to continue to remember what happened under Stalin. I'm afraid that the history of repression, the family stories that we've collected are very inconvenient for this new official history that's being wheeled out by Putin and his ideologues.
And they're even giving medals to a spy on the American Atom Bomb Project, who just got a big medal, a posthumous medal from Putin the other day. Paul is calling from Wayland, Mass. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'd like the professor to address a strange phenomenon. He's probably aware of the case of Mikhail Kalashnikov, the inventor and developer of the Kalashnikov rifle. Mr. Kalashnikov, he was a sergeant in the Red Army, and he conceived and developed that rifle. And his father, like mine, as a matter of fact, I am 70 years old, and I was there at the time that you're discussing. His father was taken away and shot, as was mine. And he still saw it in his fit and his sense of pride or whatever to give the government that abused his family so cruelly this marvelous invention, which went a long way towards improving the infantry performance of the Red Army. And I wonder if this is peculiar Russian, this servile truckling to your oppressor, or whether this is a human trait elsewhere or everywhere. As you pointed out earlier, that these people still, in spite of all they suffered, supported their government and praised it even retroactively. And the case of Mikhail Kalashnikov, I think, deserves a special study on this, in this regard.
Paul, thank
you. Could I have your comment on
that? Yeah. Orlando?
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, I think it's something connected to a much broader phenomenon that we found in our project, and that is that the children of victims of repression who are burdened with this stigma of what I'd call a spoilt biography. In other words, you know, if they admit to that they're going to suffer discrimination because of the of their parents' repression, there's a very strong tendency, which is perhaps human, but also I think enforced by the Soviet system and its propaganda networks, to overcome that stigma of oppression by succeeding in Soviet society, by being recognized as an equal in Soviet society. So the only way they can do that is by doing better than everybody else at school, by joining the Komsomol, by gaining recognition. And so perhaps the Kalashnikovs of the Soviet world overcame that stigma to some extent by proving themselves, by proving their worth.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. Yes, go ahead. Excuse me.
Yeah. So one example of that, I mean, it's a woman who begins and ends the book, is Antonina Golovina, who, like Dmitry Streletsky, came from a kulak family. Her father was sent to a labor camp, and she and her mother and younger brothers were sent to a special settlement in Siberia. And she came back from that in mid-1930s and really suffered from this stigma of a spoilt biography. She was very bright and individualistic, and she wanted to get on in Soviet society and be accepted as an equal, and that was a question of her dignity, I think, as much as anything else. And she suffered from discrimination at school. She was not allowed to join the pioneers. So eventually, because she wanted to go to medical school, she concealed her biography. Many people did that. You had a choice. You could either declare your spoilt biography, in which case you would suffer discrimination at every corner, or you could do as Antonina did, which was to make up her biography and buy forged papers, which she did. For 40 years, she lived like that. She didn't tell her husband. She was married to two men, and both of them for more than 20 years, and neither knew anything about her kulak origins. None of her colleagues at the pediatric institute where she worked for 30 years knew anything about her kulak origins. She didn't tell her daughter anything about it either. And yet she became a very successful doctor. She joined the party in 1962. She says she did that not because she believed in the system. I don't know about Kalashnikov, but I know that Antonina says that she didn't believe in it. She did it to protect herself, to protect her daughter, and to advance her career. And she did that knowingly. Funnily enough, it was only quite by accident that she ever found out about her husband's spoilt biography. It turned out for more than 40 years she'd known this man, had his child, and didn't know that he too had come from a family that had been repressed. Quite by accident, one day in the late 1980s, an elderly aunt of her husband turned up looking for him and let slip that he was the son of a Tsarist naval officer who'd been shot by the Bolsheviks in 1917. So all this time, for 40 years,
they'd
lived with each other, had a child together, but had not told each other anything about their spoilt past.
And had passed on almost what you call a genetic fear that seems to be still there in Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the later stages of the project, I became very interested in this. It seemed to me that this is one thing, and I think Memorial and I learned more about it than anything else, which is that repression affects not just the person and the family and the people around that family. It comes down through several generations, and it's passed down by what Aminant was talking about earlier, about people not talking to their children. And somehow that sends signals down to children, passes down a fear which builds up inhibitions in the younger generation. So we did lots of interviews with people who came into maturity in the 60s and 70s, in the age of the dissidents, who had parents who'd been repressed. And we found that although they may sympathize with the dissidents, something inside them stopped them becoming active dissidents. And we think that had, I think we've shown that had strong connections with
this fear.
What they inherited, this fear, their genetic fear, they call it themselves.
We've been talking this hour with renowned historian Orlando Figes. He's the author of the new book, The Whisperers. Thank you so much for joining us this hour. And thank you for our callers. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website on onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.